Welcome to the MillOCG podcast, the podcast which explores multilingualism and imagined geographies as sources of creativity for world literature. Led by researchers at SOAS and funded by the European Research Council, this project focuses on three significant geographies: North India, the Maghreb, and the Horn of Africa. This is the third podcast from the Postcolonial Print Cultures Conference held at SOAS on the 11th and 12th of January 2019. Dr. Ravani Rana Sinha from King's College London will discuss Tambamutti and Shivanandan, Cold War America and International Socialism. This talk considers and contrasts the political positions and self-fashioning of two mid-century Sri Lankan writers, Tambamutti and Shivanandan.
So my paper then compares the political implications of two very divergent Sri Lankan diasporic or transplanted perspectives during the Cold War years. So I'm going to be thinking about the influential Sri Lankan poet and editor Tambamutti, who was born in 1915, who moved to Britain in the late 1930s, but also spent a decade in the US during the Cold War. And I'll be also looking at the radical ideologue, Shivanandan, who was born in 1923, so a little bit later, but who also moved to the UK in the late 1950s, where he was director of the International Institute of Race Relations, editor of Race and Class in Britain, and espoused international socialism until his death last year in 2018. I'll begin with a brief outline of Tambamutti because I'm not sure how familiar some of you may be with his work. So in 1915, then, the Sri Lankan poet and editor Tambamutti was born into a middle-class, English-speaking, Roman Catholic Tamil family, which had strong literary and publishing interests in colonial Sri Lanka, then Ceylon. Barely fluent in his native Tamil, Tambamutti's colonial education at a Catholic convent in the north of Sri Lanka continued in the capital, ensured that his first language was English and his second was Latin. So long before he moved to Britain in 1938, he published cosmopolitan poems that suggest he had absorbed indigenous configurations of interwar modernism, articulated, for example, in the hybrid fusions of the Sri Lankan poet and painter George Keats. He's inspired by Picasso, by Sri Lankan temple painting, so a very hybrid identity. On arrival in Britain, Tambamutti, on the eve of the outbreak of the Second World War in 1938, Tambamutti swiftly established himself with an assortment of poets, artists, and bohemians who were regularly to be found in Fitzrovia, the name that Tambamutti gave for the area between Fitzroy Square and Soho Square. And these included George Barker, William Ebsen, Gavin Hewitt. And then Tambamutti went on then to co-found the Poetry London magazine, and he went on to edit the first 14 numbers. And it was really the main poetry magazine of the war. It published important English and international writers of the day, such as Walter de la Mare, Spender, McNeice, and Dilip Thomas. He was also the first to recognize emerging talents such as Kathleen Raine and Keith Douglas. But he had a dynamic influence on the content and format of British books and magazines, commissioning artists such as Henry Moore, Lucian Freud, and Barbara Hepworth, among others, to design covers for his publishing imprint and for his illustrated texts. He particularly championed the sensuous, the impromptu, the incantatory poetry that was associated with the new romanticists and with a group he called the New Moderns, so Raine, Barker, Thomas, David Gascoigne. But this anti-rationalist stance that emerges in his editorials in Poetry London cohere with the self-stereotyping of the untamed Oriental that he embraced on his arrival in the UK. So in short then, his assimilation into British literary society was mediated by his kind of cooperation with essentially spiritual representations of the subcontinent set up in opposition to Western rationality. But for our purposes then, after living in Britain for over a decade, this colourful figure decided in 1952 to exchange London's Fitzrovia for bohemian artist communities in New York's Greenwich Village, where he settled from 1952 to 1968. And he set up a Poetry London, New York magazine, and other adventures. But his move to the US then coincided with a shift away from neo-romanticism in Britain, but also the rise of working class culture in the UK. And as I suggested, it was after coming to the UK that he adopted this self-conscious South Asian identity. It was this literal and metaphorical self-fashioning was heightened by the move to New York, which seemed to act as a kind of catalyst for an even more heightened self-translation. I think, and North American interest in very esoteric aspects of Hinduism illuminate his reception. So Vogue Beatnik, Allen Ginsberg, and Jack Kerouac, the Bohemian, and the heightened interest in the Eastern way to personal authenticity all help produce a more Hindu version of the actually Catholic Thambimuthu. But also, as we will see, this move to New York produced a much more strategic political shift and sub-translation. So I want to explore really how his publications in America then were interpolated by larger propaganda movements against communism and shaped by the political culture of Cold War America, but also how he sort of cooperated in that movement. And but also to think about how US editors had a very different agenda to British ones in the publishing of certain of the work of certain South Asian intellectuals within this context of the military, political, ideological rivalry between communist and capitalist systems. So Thambimuthu then began writing for the literary and political magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, in October 1953. And this was shortly after the end of the Korean War in 1953, when the US was particularly paranoid about communist propaganda. So like, as we've heard earlier, the CIA-funded anti-communist literary and political magazine, The Encounter magazine, The Atlantic Monthly similarly aimed to produce a counter-intellectual movement to communism. So in Atlantic Monthly's special issue entitled Perspective of India, Thambimuthu's leading article entitled Indian Poetry, Its Heritage and New Direction, appears alongside essays and stories from a range of writers, Narayan, Mukhrajanand, Raja Rao, Nayantara Sagal, and Vijay Lakshmi Pandit. But this special issue has clearly been co-opted into this larger propaganda movement. The editorial by Harvey Bright claims the purpose of the supplement was simply to showcase the writing and culture of, I quote, contemporary countries whose achievements are little known in the US, and to further a sense of intellectual community within these countries. However, as it goes on, the real agenda to maintain contact with South Asian intellectuals and to preempt leanings to communism becomes clear, and I quote, while in many instances, the South Asian writer is oriented towards the West, especially if he has had a British education, he may also be one who feels a magnetic pull towards Moscow or Mao. He is often an Indian Democrat who, like some of his political leaders, identifies the West with imperialism and therefore views it with distrust. And who can blame him, Bright goes on. In India, where illiteracy is a basic problem, the intellectual plays a weighty role in his country's life. Far more than we can imagine, he helps create the climate of opinion. We ought not to neglect him. It remains for us to exchange our ideas with those of the Indian reader and to show him we are not indifferent to the creative process wherever we find it. And I think this kind of connects to what Tisha was saying about the context in which these Indian writers found it so hard to be published. So in many ways, the fact that these writers, these editors were taking them on was significant and problematic. But I want to further argue then that Thambimuthu's work in the US needs to be seen in relation to the expanded role of the US on the world stage at this time, when North America then presented its anti-communism as anti-imperialistic during this Cold War period. Because what's especially revealing about is how sort of North American inflected critiques of British colonialism appear in Thambimuthu's work for the first time after he moves to New York. So in contrast to his early silence on colonialism or imperialism when in the UK, his writing in the US marks a new anti-colonial thrust. And this direction appears in this article on poetry published in Atlantic Monthly, where Thambimuthu now critiques the former colonized country's writers' capacity to be influenced by Western poets, which is ironic given how his own early poetry derives very easily from some of his English poets. Here he criticizes for the first time how Indian poets have been influenced by extreme westernization and that they are only now, he says, making a slow recovery. So in this work, we can see how certain native informants, if you like, from the formerly colonized countries, such as Thambimuthu, are giving support to this American self-representation as a custodian of decolonization during the Cold War years. Because it's significant that Thambimuthu found this role as a native informant on Sri Lankan society and Sri Lankan culture only after moving to New York. He never published anything about Sri Lanka while he was in the UK during that first phase. And he first published creative autobiographical short stories on Sri Lankan society in a range of North American literary magazines. And these semi-autobiographical stories are interesting in many ways. They're laden with details of rituals and customs, and they depict really the privileged existence of this Tamil landed leisured class, and gives us really interesting insights into the relationship between exotic subjects and their metropolitan consumers. But it is this Tamil Mukhi's new mocking of the Anglomania of westernized Sri Lankans, like himself, in these stories that is relevant here. So in his short story entitled Uncle Gami and the British, which he published in The Reporter in 1954, Tamil Mukhi satirizes Uncle Gami for wanting the resident English and Scotsman in colonial Sri Lanka to patronize him in, I quote, the make-believe that he was near English. And again, Tamil Mukhi is either subconscious or blind to the fact and how he has exemplified at least the very type of person that he is mocking. However, if Tamil Mukhi's assertions then of cultural difference do not transform the center or the dominant discursive narratives of the period, this product of an elite conservative social formation, I think, needs to be seen not as representative, but in relation to historically contingent figures from a variety of class and political backgrounds. So in my work on South Asian writers in Britain, I have explored how Tamil Mukhi's politics then stands in marked contrast to his more radical contemporaries, such as Anand and Rao. But I think his trajectory also merits fruitful comparison with, as I've mentioned, Sivanandan, who settled in the UK two decades later in 1958, but who revolutionized race and class politics within the context of Britain recasting itself over a transitional era of post-war decolonization and Cold War politics. And in contrast to Tamil Mukhi's very conservative, if you like, apolitical class stance in some way, Sivanandan's active involvement with the Trotskyite Lanka Sama Samaja Party, the LSSP, as a student in colonial Sri Lanka, clarifies and makes sense of his affinity with international socialism on his arrival in Britain in 1958. The LSSP, where he was a member, and his lecturers at the University of Peravinia were all steeped in the LSSP movement and influenced Sivanandan. It was one of the most successful Trotskyite movements or international socialist movements. From its foundation in 1935 until it was expelled from the Fourth International in 1964 because it joined a coalition government. The Sri Lankan Freedom Party, the LSSP nevertheless played a decisive role in Sri Lanka's politics. And Sivanandan played a part in its mobilization of trade unions, strikes, and anti-colonial demonstrations as a young man. At first, the LSSP fought the contentious Sinhala-only Act, and it served to constitute the main political opposition party in Sri Lanka. So these then are the non-European revolutionary perspectives and radical traditions in which Sivanandan's political consciousness, now transplanted in Britain, was forged. And so I think his activism in Britain emerged within a context, of course, of anti-racist socialist and black nationalist movements in Britain and the UK. So international socialism then formed a natural context for Sivanandan during these Cold War years and beyond. His long career was characterized by a tireless determination to fight the racism and disempowerment experienced by black British working class communities. However, Sivanandan's self-representation remained assertively third worldist rather than Sri Lankan or British. And he negotiated his identity in terms of an international socialism that was not aligned to a particular racial identity or geographical location. Mm-hmm. As he said in many interviews, that he drew on Marxism as a way to interpret the world in order to change it. And Sivanandan then remolded then the institution of race relations in London into Britain's first anti-imperialist, anti-racist think tank, but he provided a venue for Marxist internationalism and third world socialist struggles worldwide. The title change of the Institute of Race Relations Journal from race to race and class under his guidance pointed, I think, to his commitment to counter those in the left within the West that saw race as subordinate to class. And I think these radical concerns of his journal and on of the Institute could not be more different from the sort of rarefied aesthetic preoccupations of Tamil Mukhi's Poetry London or Poetry London New York, which did not point to or produce as race and class did, in a radical rethinking of internationalism or world politics. I think Itamamut then remains an influential, interesting account of that, a different negotiation. I think Sivanandam then has inspired several generations of anti-racist socialists, as the many comments to the race and class issue in his honour bear testimony.
Thanks for listening to the Moon OCG podcast. In our next episode from the Postcolonial Print Cultures Conference, we'll be listening to Duncan Yoon discussing Osman Sembene and the aesthetics of third worldism.